Hello, listeners. Welcome, welcome. This is Federica, your host for So Did You Hear. I am back in the studio after it's been, it feels like forever. It's been like 3 weeks since we've done a live show, I think. So it, it's been a little while, but let me tell you, it feels good to be in the studio. You know, sometimes life just gets, kind of hits you all at once and you need to take a little break. And that's kind of how life has been the last couple weeks. This transition, I feel like this transition from the winter is still like lingering, and it's been almost weird to readjust to like real life is like, or whatever this version of normalcy we're switching back into. So it's really an interesting time, and just kind of needed to take a little break, and I think that was very helpful. So now I'm really excited to be back, and today I have two very interesting guests, and we're going to talk about something that is very rapidly evolving here in Spokane and all across the country, and it's something that is very fascinating to me as someone who is interested in psychology as well as creating positive social change and just learning about the evolving world of therapy and psychology and as well as the legal and social implications of those changes. And so we're going to be talking specifically about the decriminalization process of controlled substances, more specifically psilocybin use. Psilocybin being the active component in what are known as magic mushrooms. These are substances that for a long time have been criminalized through kind of the war on drugs era. And recently, in the last decade or so, there have been a lot of shifts and changes in the U.S. legal system and in the scientific field as far as reconsidering the potential uses and research value of these substances in using them in things like therapy and treatment for disorders like PTSD, anxiety, etc. So really, really juicy stuff. There's a lot to talk about from the legal side, the social implication side, and everything that kind of connects to that. So here with me today, we have Mason Lord, who is the chair of Decriminalize Spokane, and Pat Donahue, a local attorney and a legal counsel for Decriminalize Spokane, and they are going to help us have this just kind of dig into this really interesting topic. So thank you guys for being here today.
Thank you so much, Federica. It's been a long time coming. I'm glad we can make this happen.
Yeah, me too. I think it's going to be a very, very, we have a lot to talk about, so I'll try to kind of keep it condensed, but I would love for you guys to kind of go into your background. And then, Pat Donahue, you are a lawyer, you're a legal, or a local attorney here, and you are doing legal counsel for Decriminalize Spokane, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Thanks a lot for having me today. I'm a local criminal defense attorney, and I volunteer my time for Decriminalize Spokane as their legal counsel.
Awesome. So, tell me just a little bit about, like, what your guys' background is, how you came to be doing the work you're doing today with Decriminalize Spokane, and what is the organization about? Why are you doing what you're doing?
My name is Mason Lord, and I am the chair of Decriminalize Spokane. Ultimately, I started on that path back when I was in college and became the president of a Students for Sensible Drug Policy chapter in the state of Vermont. Decided to focus on psychedelic studies, working directly with the organization out of Washington, D.C., and, it was really cool to get involved in that field. Ultimately led me to the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, another nonprofit in drug policy reformation. So they helped me do research with a neurochemist on certain psychedelic substances. And, after that, I wound up attending different events offering psychedelic harm reduction services. And here we are now, hoping to decriminalize, which on a greater scale is harm reduction for society. So
Sounds great. And go ahead.
So my name's Pat Donahue. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I've been practicing going on 8 years now. And I sort of entered that space due to deeply held beliefs I have about the devastation that the war on drugs has brought to our brothers and sisters and a desire to fight to end that. After about like I said, 7 years in that sort of space, I've come to believe that our way out of this hairball isn't through fighting it, but it's through changing the system to make the current system irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And so, as I mentioned, I'm volunteering my time with Decriminalize Spokane to help push this psilocybin initiative forward. But personally, on a larger scale, I'm looking to help create a robust regulatory framework allowing for safe and legal access to these medicines, and and certainly to stop the incarceration of individuals for possessing them as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I gained from following this, the movement, both Decriminalize Spokane, the legal process here in Spokane and regionally in Washington as well as the greater world, the movement to reshape the way our society interacts with these controlled substances, it kind of revolves around a couple different main points. One is investigating the potential beneficial medical uses of these substances, as well as reducing the impact of criminalization on our society, and how criminalizing certain behaviors such as substance use has really impacted our society. So those are what I hear are like the biggest potential areas of change that this kind of research or this movement is aiming to create. Does that sound about right?
It does, and just to emphasize on the you know, community-based effort that we're involved in, because ultimately we do acknowledge the potential medical benefits of these substances, but the reality is that we are in the decriminalization territory for a reason, and that's because we believe that these substances really belong in the community and less through gatekeepers, if that makes sense. So if, you know, you have psilocybin only available through the medical community, that means that you're going to pretty much need a diagnosis, and also needing to have tried other medicines that maybe did not work. Although that might not always be the case for everybody, when it comes to access to these medicines, it's still going to be extra steps for people who, let's say, maybe want to, you know, go out on a hike and use these substances as opposed to in a clinic. You know, so we are specifically trying to acknowledge the medical potential, but we just want to focus more on the community-based effort and access.
Accessibility.
Yes, absolutely.
So to me, that kind of sounds, that reminds me a little bit about, you know, how marijuana was legalized here in Washington. Of course, we were one of the first states to legalize medicinal and then later on recreational marijuana. And so can we kind of compare it to, like, say, when marijuana was still in the phases of decriminalization, it was when medical marijuana became more of an option, you had to have gone through several doctors or have a diagnosis, and it had to be kind of a last-minute resort. You can only get it through certain clinics. And, of course, I mean, that's still the reality for a lot of people, especially living outside of Washington, where that are earlier in the stages of decriminalization. But this reminds me of that sort of process. And so it seems like it's kind of it's a bit of a painstaking process.
Well, people mistake legalization for like this idea of freedom, but legalizing something means it's going to be regulated by the authority. So when you decriminalize a substance, it kind of more or less creates a bit of a separation from the system, which, you know, ultimately we think there could be a coexistence between legalizing and decriminalizing eventually, but we think that having the decriminalization happen before legalization would give us a voice when it comes to the regulating authorities stepping in and wanting to have their say.
Okay.
And the decriminalization movement, I think, also recognizes the individual's liberty or perhaps religious interest in using these molecules for personal gain in a way that doesn't adversely affect society.
I think it's really important to kind of understand why is this so important, and what what are the potential, what are these uses, like, for these substances? What does the research tell us, or what are we learning about how these substances like psilocybin can be used as medicinal or spiritual medicines, as you say, and why is it important, or is it important that our society shifts their perspective on our general, like, the legal and social relationship to them? And then, yeah, where do we go from there with the decriminalization process? So, I know that was loaded. I can break it up.
You know, that question brought me right to, you know, the Good Friday experiment, which took place, I think it was a guy named, it was Dr. Pankey or something. Excuse me if I'm wrong with that name. But an affiliate, Dr. Bill Richards, was involved in the Good Friday experiment. This was at Harvard. They had 10 theology students go to church, a church service, and also ingest psilocybin. 9 out of 10 of them agreed it was the most spiritual experience of their entire life. And then the 10th person, I think 6 to 8 months later, wrote back to the study and said, hey, that actually was also the most spiritual experience of my entire life. So this guy, Bill Richards, is still directly involved in the psilocybin research at Johns Hopkins University. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's helping them research the medicinal benefits. And actually, a big part of the research is, like, can the mystical experience actually help in the process of healing? Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a bit of intermingling going on. But, you know, they're researching, for example, like, end of life, you know, if somebody is coming near the end of their life, they are doing research on how psilocybin can help those people accept that and actually feel better about their situation. Mm-hmm. They're also doing the research on how it can help people who have depression, also to help people with addiction, with alcohol and nicotine. You know, there's lots of different potential avenues, but ultimately the research is still tied in from the very foundation of this to the spiritual aspects that it also has.
Yes, I've heard a lot about psilocybin uses in treatment for things like anxiety, PTSD as well. So in perhaps it could offer an alternative avenue for people who are suffering with these conditions, for whom maybe traditional therapy or traditional like drugs like antidepressants, et cetera, just like aren't working. So I think from what I'm hearing, there's a lot of potential for new and maybe better treatment for people who are not getting for whom, you know, they've tried other avenues and it hasn't worked, or just want to take a more, maybe something that they feel is more natural, holistic way for them to approach their own mental health and well-being. Is that right?
If I can jump in quickly here, yeah, I think that is right. And I think what we have is we have a long and well-documented history of an approach that has failed us. Mm-hmm. Basically, we've used the criminal justice system to treat the symptoms of these conditions, whether it's substance abuse, anxiety, or depression, and we haven't addressed the causes. And Decrim Spokane, as well as I believe, that these molecules will allow or do allow people, afford people the tools they need to better themselves and to avoid this system in the first place.
Mm. Interesting. That's, so from what I'm hearing, you know, I'm thinking, and I don't know if you can speak specifically to, like, the treatment. Because I know that that's kind of going more into the medical side of things, but so it could be an alternative to say, like, instead of taking antidepressants every day, say you could do, for some people, from my basic, very basic understanding of the research that's been done, people who have undergone some of these studies have gone to treatments where it's like they do a session or a couple sessions of therapy with a professional while using with the substance, and it kind of, and then it usually ends, right? It's not like a continuous, like, you take the substance every day. It's very...
Exactly. And okay. This is one of the, you know, I would say, you know, a lot of people might point out that when it comes to big pharma offering, you know, a treatment to a disorder, it's usually going to, you know, be a continued prescription. You're talking about a cure, which mm-hmm. is exactly maybe one of the reasons why something like psilocybin that we've known has potential since the 60s hasn't been further researched into. Now, I don't know if that's the reason, but some people might say, hey, you know, like, there's a cure that we have right here, and our medical system doesn't necessarily support cures. That being said, I was in a near-fatal car accident. My life was totally saved in a hospital, and, like, I'm all for getting, you know, medical treatment when you need it. However, I also recognize that during my recovery from this car accident, I was also using alternative medicines, you know, that were really helping me, that being cannabis and, you know, psilocybin as well, actually, helping me stay in a positive mindset. You know, so it's really just making sure that people have the option, you know, and that ultimately they're not viewing themselves as a criminal just because they're deciding to take an alternative route, mm-hmm. Which can in itself be harmful mm-hmm. to an individual.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And of course, you know, the in order for all this research to progress, you know, there's a lot of legal changes and a lot of kind of legal hurdles, I guess we could call them, that organizations like Decrim Spokane or MAPS, which, forgive me, I forget the acronym.
So it's the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, which is, like we mentioned before we came into the studios, the world is the largest decriminalization advocacy organization out there. Is that, does that?
They, right? You know, they actually are more working towards legalization and treatment.
Okay.
That nonprofit specifically has done a lot of work in the field of treatment using different substances.
Okay, so more on the legalization treatment side.
Yep.
So, and of course, you know, as we're talking here, obviously I'm hearing there's a distinction that I think we need to understand, and like how these movements can progress. You know, on the legal side, maybe, Pat, you can really kind of dig into what that looks like. And first of all, so let's, you know, we touched upon this a little bit, but what's the difference between, like, decriminalization and legalization, and what does that mean and look like for the community and the process of research, of this movement and research going forward?
And if I could just jump in real quick, Pat, pretty much just to point out, legalization of these substances is going to bring the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, involved. Decriminalization does not, and that's really all I needed to say there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think Mason's right there, where legalization is a robust regulatory framework, where decriminalization, to me, means immediately stopping the practice of putting people behind bars for the nonviolent possession of these molecules.
So decriminalization basically takes away restriction or criminalization, like penal. It detaches the substance use and treatment from the judicial system and being like penalized.
Correct. And I want to address a distinction here too, where you can still regulate the behavior. For instance, in our city, there are regulations against disorderly conduct, which apply equally if you're, you know, intoxicated on alcohol or sober. You could prosecute the behavior of an individual under the influence of psilocybin who is, you know, perhaps causing a scene, in the same way you could regulate that behavior of an individual who is under the influence of alcohol. The sort of difference is with psilocybin, we're criminalizing the molecule and not the behavior.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where a decriminalization movement would be more toward decriminalizing possession, potentially simple adult transfer of the molecule or substance, and then regulating the behavior separately from it.
Okay. So that makes sense. Whereas legalization then would make the consumption or possession of said substance subject to more regulation?
Definitely. Subject to business licenses, or subject to allowing a consumer to have access to more information about the production, the conditions under which the substance was produced and distributed.
Or a guy named Peter Thiel, who has a $2 billion psilocybin firm already up and running, or Compass Pathways, which is a corporation that has attempted to patent psilocybin. So, you know, that is what you're looking at when it comes to legalization, is actual corporations backed by a lot of money, you know, who are going to be the ones who want to take it out of the hands of the little guy, if that makes sense.
I've heard a lot of similar arguments about what's happening in the marijuana and cannabis industry, where there is full legalizations, including here in Washington. There's sort of a industrialization of those industries, which can create unbalanced competition for smaller producers and whatnot. Kind of like you see in every other kind of legal product, the bigger organizations with more money and more assets may start to take some of the lion's share of the profits and so on and so forth. So, does that sound about right?
That sounds about right. And I think cannabis, the transition from decriminalizing to legal recreational cannabis, will provide the psychedelic space a lot of lessons, good and bad, and inform our decisions moving forward. For instance, I believe currently Washington State is, I believe, the only legal recreational state that does not allow home grow. So in Washington State, to comply with the law, you're not allowed to produce your own cannabis, and you have to depend on a licensed
retailer. I didn't know that. Yes, because Colorado, I grew up in Colorado. My family's there, and I go to visit from time to time, and know that the laws there do look a little different. I think you can have up to like 6 plants or something like that, 3 of which can be flowering at a time. It looks a little bit different. In speaking of policy and policy change, before we came into the studio today, we were talking about what the situation looks like on the legal side here in Washington. And from what I understand, it's pretty crazy. There's a lot of crazy changes happening. So, what step of the process are we in with decriminalization, or just what is the law enforcement and the legal side of the movement look like right now? What are we looking at?
Without exaggeration, it's developing day by day. It looks like a big hairball. In short, in Washington State, prior to February 2021, possession of any of these controlled substances was a felony. And then our state Supreme Court struck that law down and ruled it unconstitutional, which effectively decriminalized drugs in our state up until the first of this month, when a new bill went into effect. This new bill makes the possession of controlled substances a simple misdemeanor, which is better than a felony. It's a less severe punishment than a felony, but it could still carry a punishment of up to 90 days in jail and up to a $1,000 fine. And its possession is still criminalized. This new bill is a mess. I think there are very few people in the state that understand it. And our court system, I don't think, knows quite yet how we're gonna respond to it.
So, can you give us kind of like a nutshell look at what everything looks like right now?
Sure can. I can give you a couple of key points. The first kind of point of this bill is that I'm tempted to use this language, but it's kind of like a two strikes law, where an officer who encounters someone who's possessing a controlled substance is encouraged to refer the individual to a treatment program, a regional treatment program. That hasn't been created yet, doesn't exist.
Okay.
the The bill also, beginning July 1, 2022, has an educational and training component to it, where law enforcement personnel will be required to complete basic law enforcement training on interacting with people with substance abuse disorders, which I think is a great thing for our state. Mm-hmm. The kind of going back to the two strikes thing is, if law enforcement agency records reflect that an individual has kind of twice been sent to these deferral programs, they may, but they're not required to send the individual then into the district court system, or the basically misdemeanor court system. The big question about all of this, though, is what these diversion programs are going to look like and how they're going to be established and what law enforcement's going to do in the meantime. Currently, my understanding is these programs don't exist. Mm. So I imagine what's going to happen is we're going to be left in this gray space. We're left in this gray space again where technically possession of these substances is a crime, but without the sort of criminal justice framework in place to deal with these cases, law enforcement may be left not enforcing the laws on the books, mm-hmm. which is in many ways the worst possible outcome here.
Okay. So these deferral programs, it sounds like, if I'm understanding correctly, say there is a like substance use related incident or somebody has a mental health related incident, maybe they're causing a scene, having a health emergency. And instead of, like, if this were to actually all, be in place, there would be an agency that is able to respond rather than, like, police showing up on the scene where somebody's having, is in distress or is having a mental health crisis or substance use crisis, like an overdose. This overdose is probably a bad example because that's pretty specific to other kind of substance uses. Although I guess it could apply to that as well if this were all working. But you would have somebody who's trained in mental health crises, in substance abuse or a substance use and crisis and response, rather than a law enforcement agencies. The people would just be better trained to respond to that specific circumstance.
Potentially. Right? What the bill does more specifically is it creates a program of individuals to advise the state as to a community-based treatment and long-term management of people with substance abuse disorders.
Okay.
And so this sort of committee is going to be formed. It includes a bunch of different people from a bunch of different facets of elected officials, of prosecutors, of defense attorneys, of substance abuse professionals, chemical dependency professionals. And this board in the next year is going to create recommendations for the state moving forward. Mm-hmm. Importantly, the bill that's on the books now expires in 2 years, July 1st, 2023. And the point of that is to sort of light a fire under the legislature to take these recommendations from this board and to make progress going forward, or to establish a new course going forward, mm-hmm. when this bill sunsets.
Okay.
I'm personally quite reluctantly excited about that. One thing I think that could come out of this is perhaps this advisory committee could look at the use of ketamine-assisted therapy for the treatment of people with substance abuse disorders. Mm. And there are some studies showing that ketamine-assisted therapy can facilitate abstinence from addiction for individuals who have formed addictions or dependency on cocaine, on alcohol, and other molecules. Mm. And perhaps, this committee will look at that research and allow our state to sort of investigate these alternative psychedelic-assisted therapies to assist individuals who are suffering.
Hmm. I think that the potential for use for substance abuse treatment is what really, I know to me personally, is fascinating about like this research side of it. I think if you're, say, we all kind of grew up during the legacy of the war on drugs era, all drugs are bad, just say no, the spiel. And a lot of times the ways that like we're introduced, I know like for me the way I was introduced to like my relationship with my understanding of like all these different substances is, everything gets kind of get lumped into one category. Drugs are bad, etc. And now when you're mentioning things like psilocybin, magic mushrooms, ketamine, or like even MDMA has been studied by other organizations for therapy-assisted research or research into therapy. I think it's important to acknowledge a lot of people may kind of like just it may be jarring for people who've been taught, you know, that you've been beaten into your head, you know, all drugs are bad, stay away, and now it's kind of the movement is saying something different. And so it creates kind of a cognitive dissonance for people who might be unfamiliar with the movement or with the research and the legal side. How does that, do you think that is a factor at play with the legal process?
Not just the legal process, but in the research, you know, in academia. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, I happened upon a study that was in 2011. Some researchers were actually, you know, trying to detect a substance known as DMT or dimethyltryptamine in the human body. And they actually detected it in the optic nerve of a human being. So that study actually was halted due to the cognitive dissonance that it would actually cause for society on a greater scale. I think they compared it to like as if an alien invasion happened, because we're talking you know, a Schedule 1 controlled substance that turns out is actually in our optic nerve, which is where like everything we see is kind of like created in our brain. So it's you know, a big issue with the research. And I mean, you know, just talking to the general population, I think it's true. A lot of people are still kind of caught in the old mindset of, you know, drugs are bad, okay, but, you know, this is really on part of the unraveling, you know, of that process. But I mean, it really is that just really rings a bell and brings up a very interesting study. I just never had read a study before that said it was stopped because they did not want to continue to see where the results would bring them.
Just because they discovered that it was there. So this is a completely naturally occurring substance in the human body.
Yes.
That they discovered, and then so they realized that it was this compound that is also, I think, present. It acts as a psychedelic if ingested or smoked, if I understand properly.
It's the active constituent in ayahuasca.
Okay, yeah. And so then they realized the same component is, but it's in your body, but then that was just halted because, I guess, it was maybe like fear of this finding, or...
It's the the cognitive dissonance that would be caused by, you know, a research study saying a Schedule 1 controlled substance is present in not only the human body, but your optic nerve. So that was the specific reason they stopped the study. But, yeah.
There's a lot of misinformation out there. You know, I think dating back to Nancy Reagan and Just Say No, and the kind of alternative to that I've heard is Just Say No, KNOW. Clearly, this Just Say No, NO mindset led to, you know, an opioid overdose crisis for our generation. This was not effective policy. This was not a good idea. And instead, we should encourage a shift towards Just Say No, KNOW, and an honest discussion about the benefits and harms of these molecules. And hopefully, along with that, a lightening of the stigma. You know, it's difficult for, you know, professionals in even our community in the Northwest here to come forward and to talk about positive experiences they may have had on psychedelics when they're concerned that their peers will say they've fried their brain or they've, you know, lost control.
Right. And because you mentioned it, I really, you can't, it's hard to have a conversation about this without mentioning the scheduling system. And just for reference, from what I understand currently, there are four schedules?
There are actually five.
Or five.
There are five schedules.
So go ahead.
You want to go down them? Yeah.
Yeah, I would love that.
So we've got Schedule 1, and these are really fascinating because they don't, in my opinion, appear to be based in reality.
And Schedule 1, what is that? That means that there's no potential beneficial use, high potential for addiction?
It means high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical use. Mm-hmm. And in Schedule 1, we have molecules such as LSD, cannabis, MDMA, and peyote. Mm. Schedule 2 is a schedule that classifies high potential for abuse with potentially leading to severe psychological or physical dependence. Cocaine, methamphetamine, Oxycontin, fentanyl, Adderall, Ritalin, molecules like that. Schedule 3 contains drugs with moderate to low potential for physical and psychological dependence. Anabolic steroids, ketamine, testosterone. Schedule 4, drugs with moderate to low potential for physical and psychological dependence, things like Xanax, Ativan, Ambien. And then Schedule 5, you actually have things like Robitussin, things more
cough syrup.
Yeah, available at the counter. But it's just curious that, you know, Schedule 1 doesn't contain, like, cigarettes. No currently medical
alcohol.
alcohol, high potential for abuse, no currently accepted medical use. It's, in my opinion, a clearly outdated way of categorizing these molecules and in desperate need of reform and at the cost of, again, our suffering brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. I think what's also interesting about the scheduling system, and this is kind of a contentious point, and I will reiterate, this is not, you know, my personal opinion. This is from what I've understood from arguments or criticisms of the scheduling system. There are other modus between, like, how the scheduling system was created. There's a lot of arguments from opposition or critics of the schedule system as is, that when being created, really harm reduction and health were not necessarily the main real concerns of the legislators. It was used as an explanation to criminalize certain behaviors that were attached to certain social groups. An example I'm thinking of, I don't know if you're familiar with the book, The New Jim Crow, and that is a book that investigates the history of the criminalization of cocaine, specifically crack cocaine, and how that came to be introduced based on, well, the book reports that it had to do with what specific groups of people were using those drugs and how can the legal system criminalize those behaviors to target certain social groups, in this case specifically lower-income African-American communities. So there's a food for thought there, something that I think is worth investigating as well.
And also to honestly take it a few steps back even further to the 1930s, mm-hmm. when, you know, the Bureau of Prohibition ended, which was the prohibition of alcohol. That was run by a man named Henry Anslinger. And, you know, he actually became the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was created after the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 was passed. So that actually effectively ended the industrialization of hemp. So that was reefer madness, you know, and all of that stuff, which was, you know, purported by William Randolph Hearst, a man who owned five of the biggest newspapers in America, had investments in the timber paper making process. So, along with Dow Chemical, had a lot of investment in products like nylon, where hemp would have basically just completely taken over these industries. So, you know, they created campaigns like Reefer Madness to target, you know, cannabis use in the sense of, hey, this is a drug that makes you act crazy. Mm-hmm. And even at that time, they were saying, oh, well, the white women are going to go run off with the black men. And, you know, that was the literal, you know, way they were arguing against the use of cannabis. So it does, you know, fast forward to the Controlled Substance Act, like exactly what you just said, like it was already a running theme before then, mm-hmm. You know, that there were racist implications. Mm-hmm. You know, but that being said, it wasn't really the issue wasn't so much that cannabis was intoxicating. It was that hemp industry was going to actually just override these other industries that were up and coming. So
financial incentive, there's financial motive as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
Nixon's, I'm pretty sure Nixon's campaign advisor came out and said they couldn't make it illegal to be anti-war or left, but they could make it illegal to, they could criminalize the molecules they use, and they could make it illegal to have cannabis, for example.
Basically, you can't criminalize a minority or a political group or a social group, but you can criminalize their behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Arrest their leaders, raid their homes.
There's a lot of, that's why I think this is such a fascinating topic, because it's not just, there's the science and the research side of it, which is fascinating. But then, there's the social implications, whether you're somebody who is interested in the use of these substances or not, there are very, very real implications for the community at large and our society and how the legal system has impacted said communities, particularly communities of color, lower-income communities, and certain political groups. This is really an issue that affects everybody and is another, in my view, reflection of a kind of struggle against the status quo and powers that be, in a sense, which makes it a very big, kind of sticky issue to navigate. Makes it a very, there's a lot of moving parts to contend with. So, yeah, what does the future look like? What are kind of the next steps? What are the next steps, not only for, like, of course, the country or the nation, but specifically here, locally in Spokane, what are the next steps in the process, and what are your goals?
Well, at this point, we are collecting signatures to get our initiative on the ballot. If you sign our initiative petition, it's just saying that you want to give citizens a permission to actually vote on this cause. So it does not mean that you agree it should be decriminalized or not. It's just, hey, I want to be able to vote for it. Yes or no, definitely. If you don't think it should be decriminalized, still sign our petition, because you should be able to say no. But anyway, we'd appreciate it if you say yes. We're really not just actually protecting possession here. I just want to point out that our initiative actually acknowledges cultivation as well. Mm-hmm. With a possession of up to 6 dried ounces of psilocybin in a household of above 21 years and older. So with everything going on in the realm of, our drug possession laws changing in this state, we are still going to be making sure that the cultivation is also protected in a small scale, which is a big part of the community having access. Mm-hmm. Even if the state does decriminalize possession, it's still important to recognize that cultivation is a part of that as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to also emphasize that our bill would also decriminalize the limited adult to adult transfer of psilocybin. Okay. And our thinking behind this was, I seem to remember a time where we legalized cannabis, but there was a period where you could have it, but you couldn't buy it, you couldn't grow it, you couldn't give it away.
Right.
But you could have it. And it's just kind of silly. We want to recognize that the reality of the situation is that this molecule can be grown in limited quantities by responsible adults and transferred between responsible adults in a way that doesn't adversely impact the community. And we wanted to protect those individuals from the threat of being sent to prison.
Which leads into the fact that our initiative states specifically that there's no public transfer or public consumption allowed whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So there should never be somebody sitting in a park with their blanket out and a bag of mushrooms, in public. That actually will not be allowed, even if our initiative passes. So, we're talking about the privacy of your own home, mm-hmm. here. And, if you're going to ingest, it's going to be hopefully in a safe space that you're not going to be disrupting people, because you can still get, basically in a little bit of trouble for being out in public and bothering people. So it's just a public intoxication law, the same as alcohol.
Right, you know,
so just, you know, we're not trying to allow people to be out in public, you know, flaunting psilocybin mushrooms at all.
Two things kind of related to that. Our initiative created a public use civil infraction that mirrors the cannabis civil infraction for the open use of cannabis. Open use, possession, consumption of mushrooms would be a civil infraction, just like cannabis is.
Okay.
And also, very importantly, this initiative and law, if it were passed and put into effect, would not affect in any way the DUI laws, the driving while under the influence laws. It would still be illegal to drive while under the influence of drugs. So.
Makes sense. Well, good to know. You know, and where is... If we're interested in following up with the changes that are happening, where would be a good place for someone to get information?
So currently it's going to be the Decriminalize Spokane Facebook page. We also have Decrim _ Spokane on Instagram, I believe is the handle. And, you know, we're going to be posting things there for events. We just had an event last Wednesday, or not this past Wednesday, the Wednesday before, down at Manitou Park, and you know, a couple DJs came out. We had somebody, a local welder who makes these dodecahedron fire pits, and a table set up to collect signatures. So we had a little dance party, and you know, we're going to be planning on having that hopefully weekly, probably at Manitou on Wednesday evenings, Wednesday nights. So we set up just right at the gazebo. It's really easy to find us there. So feel free to come check us out there. You know, we'll just walk around and collect signatures there when we're, you know, posted up as well. So that might be the easiest in person. Otherwise, the Instagram and the Facebook virtually.
Great.
And then on a national and international level, again, go to MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Through their Instagram, through their website, through their other online presence, you'll be able to get access to the most up-to-date information about FDA studies and everything else.
Fantastic. Well, yeah, thank you guys for sharing all that. We are about out of time here. But, yeah, this is definitely a subject we will continue. I know I will continue to pursue. And I really want to thank you guys for coming here and talking about this today. If there's anything, if you have anything else that you want to share as before we wrap up with the public, I know now's your time to do it. And, yeah.
The only thing I can really think of, but I just do want to let people know who might be interested in getting involved in this type of work,
yes,
not only to check out MAPS website, but also specifically the Zendo Project, which is their harm reduction support group that goes around to different events, mostly international, but they are also usually at Burning Man. You know, it is called the Zendo Project. It really offers psychedelic harm reduction support. So it's mental health professionals that work with the medical team at these events to alleviate the medical team from non-life-threatening issues. You know, if you're having an overwhelming experience, you don't necessarily need help from an EMT. So check out the Zendo Project. You can volunteer with them at events.
How's that spelled for?
That's Zendo.
Zendo, Zendo Project.
Yep.
Okay, and so these are events like music festivals. I'm thinking first thing that comes to mind, music festivals, concerts, etc.
Specifically,
right?
Music festivals. You know, another group that goes to offer educational support at events would be Dance Safe. They're also a great organization as well.
Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, they can also provide testing. What are called testing kits, which is, say, if somebody purchases a certain substance, or you have a substance that, they have test kits for things like LSD, MDMA, etc.
Right, yep.
And so part of their harm reduction mission is to say, you know, if people are going to do these things, they are going to have to possess these things anyways. If they're going to do them, make sure that they can at least ensure that it is not a substance that is going to harm them, because they're, you know, when people go to purchase controlled substances, they have to do it off the black market, and there's no quality regulation there, an act there. You could be purchasing potentially harmful something that's laced with harmful substances. So they provide tester kits, which where you can use at home, which, if I understand correctly, and test if you don't know whatever substances you have to make sure that it's not laced, etc.
Absolutely. Is that right? Yeah, so adulterated substances are usually the ones when you read an article about somebody, you know, having a really bad experience at an event from taking a substance, they probably took an adulterated one. So these test kits do help you avoid that, and, you know, it takes a very small amount of whatever substance you're intending and ingesting. Take what's known as a reagent. So it's a type of liquid sold by companies like DanceSafe, and you can just put a drop of that reagent on the substance, and it will change a color that tells you if there are adulterated substances in there. So hopefully you do not ingest what you purchase if it isn't what you think it is.
Right. Quick word of caution as well. The reagents only test the portion that you test with the reagent, obviously. Mm-hmm. With molecules like fentanyl and carfentanil and the potential for cross-contamination, there remains the possibility that a portion of the remainder of the sample that wasn't tested could be, in fact, still cross-contaminated. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is no reagent is totally safe, but it definitely helps informed decision making.
Right. Yes. Of course. Nothing is completely risk free here.
You know, events like Boom out in Portugal actually do have gas chromatography chemistry setups, like, and they literally project images of, let's say, a pill, and it will list off what they have found in the test of that pill, so people at the event can avoid it. It's really just something that's not allowed in America because of the RAVE Act. And, you know, that was basically is the reason why we don't have more harm reduction services at events, because that would mean that those events were condoning drug use, which is what insurance companies will not allow.
Right, right. And if I understand, is there any motions in play to revoke or challenge that act? I think it was instituted in the early 2000s or something like that.
I think it was the 90s.
Right.
I think so. I mean, honestly, it's just something I don't like to pay a lot of attention to, except, you know, there are parents out there who have gone after it, and I believe unsuccessfully. The thing that's interesting about the RAVE Act is it's actually never been enforced. So it's there.
It's kind of a zombie law.
Pretty much.
I guess if it acts as a deterrent, then...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there's another interesting one I'll have to follow up with. I think it's really good to know that there are resources out there for harm reduction. It is an important resource that, you know, people should have. So Zendo Project, DanceSafe, and of course we'll be following up on what your organization is doing, Decrim Spokane, and MAPS is another very interesting organization to follow up on. Thanks for sharing those resources, and thank you for being on the air with me today. I think we're about out of time, so... I just really want to thank you guys, and I hope that in the future we'll maybe get to check back again and see where we're at in the process in the next conversation.
Sounds great, Frederica. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us today.
Have a good day. All right, listeners, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week. Have a wonderful rest of your day.